MechCast, Wednesday, June 19th, 2019. Hey, Mech Geeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for Mech Geeks by Mech Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast. Yeah, it's been a while, and I am very glad to be back with you. I don't know, summer's been crazy, crazy schedule, crazy things going on, but that just means we have a whole lot more Mac and Apple news to get through. So this should be a pretty packed episode, and we've got some fun stuff to talk about. We're going to dive into it in a bit, but we're going to be talking about more Mac Pro tidbits, talking about tags, Sidecar, and how that all works. Apple picking up a new company centered around automobiles and driving. And speaking of driving and directions, we're going to take a look at Lookaround, and it actually is looking pretty nice. Apple TV stuff or Apple TV Plus news to talk about. We've got to discuss Apple and their modem business. We've got iCloud expanding its reach for a new group of users, also saying goodbye to a couple bits of technology, talking about Apple Watch, Catalyst, yeah, a lot of stuff to get into in the news. And then we're going to get to some of your feedback. We're going to talk about Apple and your data and your privacy, also holes in the Mac lineup. Yeah, a few of you out there feeling the pinch of the Mac lineup, and we'll talk about that a little bit, get your thoughts on it, and then try and help a listener out with some modem issues, some data issues, cellular data issues, and that will probably round out this episode. Plenty of things to do, so I don't think we should waste any more time. Should probably jump right into it, but before we do, I want to take a quick moment and thank a show sponsor, and that is Smile. I want to talk to you about PDF Pen, because one of the awesome things about PDF Pen is they are constantly improving it. And you may have missed it, but just back in May, they upgraded and updated PDF Pen to PDF Pen 11, and it makes it even more the ultimate tool for editing PDFs on your Mac. It is the only tool I use for editing PDFs on my Mac, and I have used it for years. It's great. And I love it for doing edits, for applying signatures, making fill-in forms, and some of the new features take it to a whole new level. There's a brand new split view mode for comparing pages in a document. If you've ever had to do that, you know that is tricky. A brand new font bar that makes it a lot easier to do your text editing. They added support for Apple's really cool continuity camera feature. That means you can scan documents from your iPhone right into PDF Pen on your Mac. It also gives you the ability to add multiple items to the PDF Pen library simultaneously, and PDF Pen Pro 11 users can actually edit multiple form fields all at the same time. And that's just the surface of some of the new features. So a bunch more stuff. So whether you've been a PDF Pen user for a while, or whether you are looking for a great PDF Pen editing and management tool, just an all-around PDF viewer editor, PDF Pen is the one you should check out. And you can find more information about PDF Pen and PDF Pen Pro by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. That's smilesoftware.com/podcast. Check it out. And big thanks to Smile for their continued support of the MacCast. So we're still kind of reeling off of Worldwide Developer Conference and all of the announcements there, trying to dig in. The betas are out and floating around, and people are digging into those. So that's going to be a lot of the information we're talking about here on this episode of the MacCast. Kicking things off with more tidbits about the Mac Pro. One of the big questions is, when are we actually going to see the Mac Pro hitting the market? When can we actually buy one along with that Pro XDR display? Well, a little slip up on the Mac Pro website may have revealed the release month, at least, for the Mac Pro, or at least the one that Apple is trying to hit. Things can always change. These things are in flux until Apple actually does it. They really just said it was coming out in the fall. But for a moment on the Apple website, clicking the Notify Me button would bring up a box that would let you enter your email address so you could be notified when the Mac Pro was actually releasing. In that box, there was text that said, coming September. So September is likely the month that Apple is targeting. That text has since been changed back to coming this fall to match the app, the rest of Apple's website. So September, yep, I don't know how many of you are actually going to be purchasing a new Mac Pro. It's definitely a machine that is in the high end of the pro market, but I'm sure we have some of you in the audience. Or if not, maybe your company will buy one for you. If you're working in the film industry, it's very likely that could happen. Maybe science, technology, universities, all those sorts of things. I would love to hear from a member of the MacCast community who actually gets their hands on one of these things and gets to play around with it. I will certainly be getting into an Apple retail store to check them out because they just look amazing. Although I have to admit, the design, I really am reserving judgment till I see it in person. I have to tell you, from the screenshots, I think it looks more like an actual cheese grater than ever. And I don't know how I feel about that. I don't know if it's good or it's bad. What do you think about it? Another thing we found out that may be a little bit disappointing when it comes to the expandability, because that was one of the big features of the Mac Pro, is, hey, you can add to it, you can expand it. It's looking like the connector for the SSD modules may be proprietary. Apple Insider analyzed some of the images on Apple's website and compared it to the many different SSD connectors that are currently on the market, and none of them seem to match up 100% with Apple's design. Probably the closest connector was the mSATA connector, but the number of pins on Apple's version does seem different. A standard mSATA also couldn't match the performance specs that Apple is quoting, so they likely are using some proprietary tech in there, and that means that if a manufacturer wanted to make an SSD for the Mac Pro, they might have to go through Apple to be able to do it. Other connectors like the M.2 or the upcoming U.2, I think that's how you say that, and even the Optane also did not match the illustrations that are on Apple's Mac Pro site. So again, we're probably going to have to wait until iFixit or someone actually does a teardown to figure out exactly what's going on with that connector. But it may not be as simple as just grabbing an off-the-shelf SSD and popping it in your new Mac Pro. And we already know they did something similar with the graphics modules to gain more performance by leveraging the Thunderbolt 3 connectivity that's in the box. So you're going to have to get your graphics cards from Apple. You're also possibly going to have to get those SSDs through Apple or through actually an Apple blessed partner, but we'll have to wait and see on that. So expandability, but maybe with some caveats. You may remember, too, that in the run-up to Worldwide Developer Conference, we had heard about Apple combining the Find My iPhone and Find My Friends app into a single app, which we now know is called Find My. The other thing we had heard about was that Apple might be working on a tile-like tracking device so that you could track other things other than your iPhone or your Macs or your iPads. And we are now hearing rumors that Apple is developing that. Developers exploring the iOS 13 betas have found references and possible asset images of the device that looks to be called a tag. The product is codenamed actually B389, but the asset package that was discovered inside iOS 13 is labeled tag 1.1. That would designate the first version or first edition of that product. Interestingly, the assets also look similar to the assets that are used for other kinds of devices that you pair in close proximity to your iOS device, things like iPods or AirPods rather, and the HomePod. The device appears to look like a small round tag that could be attached to everyday objects like your keys or your glasses. It also looks to me like it might even have an LED ring, very similar to an Amazon Echo, around the outside, or at least the illustration shows a bright blue coloring. So I don't know if that would just be a colored stripe. Maybe they would have different colored tags so you could apply them to different objects. The system would use Apple's proximity technology along with the recently rebranded Find My app to allow you to find other devices. And you could even get notified if you move your iOS device too far away from a tagged object, so you're less likely to leave it behind. So again, very similar to things like the Tile. The system will let you set common locations like your home or office so that local proximity notifications could be ignored, right? You don't want to be walking around your house being notified that you've moved away from your keys. It can also play an alert to help you locate an item, so presumably it would have some sort of speaker on it. Part of the Find My app's technology that was mentioned by Craig Federighi at Worldwide Developer Conference was the ability to actually track devices even when they're offline. How does it do that? Well, it actually uses a system that uses local Bluetooth beacons that can be picked up by other iOS devices like Macs in proximity to the object. The system sends the device identifier and its location back to Apple, all in an encrypted, secure, and private manner. This is according to Apple. The system requires at least two registered Apple products to work. Those two devices work together. They generate a cryptographically strong private key that is then shared between the registered devices through end-to-end encrypted communication. The private key is actually stored on your device locally in the secure enclave or inside the T2 chip on your Mac, and then devices like the tag would be given a public key, which is used to encrypt and protect the data that is sent out by the device. The public key also rotates frequently to avoid the ability to be able to link back to previously used keys, because, you know, that's transmitting location stuff. They don't want you to be able to backtrack along that chain. So then what happens is that information can be sent, again, through other devices, may not even be your own devices, through Bluetooth until it hits a Wi-Fi, and then it can report back to Apple to help you locate your stuff. So then along the way, each device hop, the location data is actually combined and encrypted with the public key and then ultimately delivered from Apple to the device's Find My app, where it can be decrypted with that local private key, and you can get the information on where your device was. So pretty cool kind of mesh node kind of technology going on there to help you locate devices even when they're offline. So you're going to be able to find stuff even though, say, a thief or someone might try to disable the Wi-Fi. I guess if they disable the Bluetooth, though, they might be able to get around it as well. So there's still some holes in the system, but getting more robust, and it sounds pretty cool. Also, I like the idea of being able to track just everyday devices that are non-Apple devices. And it is believed that Apple could announce the tag at their iPhone event in the fall. Seems very likely to me and seems like the right place to do it. No word on what the pricing would be like, but I would imagine it would have to be relatively affordable to compete with some of the other similar products that are already on the market. Many of you are excited about the new sidecar feature that is coming to iOS 13 and macOS Catalina. This is that feature that will allow you to connect an iPad with iPadOS to a Mac running macOS Catalina via either a cable or a wireless connection, and then be able to use it as a mirrored display that you can draw on, say, with your Apple Pencil, like a graphics tablet. Well, developer Steve Troughton-Smith has been playing around with the new feature in iOS 13 beta, and at least currently, it seems like it may be locked down to just a few newer Macs. So you might have to have a newer Mac to actually be able to take advantage of the feature, at least currently in the betas. The available models that seem to work with the tech are the 27-inch iMac from late 2015, the 2016 MacBook Pro or later, the 2018 Mac Mini or later, the new Mac Pro, of course, or the 2018 MacBook Air and later, and the early 2016 MacBook Pro and newer models. There does appear to be a terminal command, though, that you can run that may enable the ability in older Macs. Steve Trotton Smith said that he has been able to use it with mixed results to get older Mac models to work with the technology. My guess is that Apple will expand support as they get further into beta testing and development when they can figure out exactly which models can deliver the best user experience and performance before they actually set the hard limit on release. So I'm guessing that they have it pretty tightly controlled in the early betas to make sure the experience is good, and then they'll slowly kind of expand it out into older and older Mac models until they figure out sort of where that limit is. There's a lot of tech going on there. We know from some of the current systems that are on the market, the third-party systems that do similar things, that this stuff is not easy, and you do need pretty high-performance graphics cards to kind of get things running. As a matter of fact, some solutions even use proprietary wireless technologies and try to take advantage of the discrete GPUs that are in your MacBook Pro, say. So does require a bit of performance, which may mean that it's going to be limited to newer devices. And sure, that's going to disappoint some people, but I think overall, what Apple tries to do is make sure that the experience is as seamless and as good as possible. And I think that's the right tact to take. News coming from the site The Information says that Apple might be acquiring the self-driving vehicle startup Drive.ai. Reportedly, Apple is said to be mostly interested in their engineering talent versus their technology, although I have to imagine that Drive.ai might have a few patents that Apple could apply to their self-driving car or self-driving vehicle system efforts. When The Information reached out to Apple for comment, they simply replied with, quote, "We don't comment on speculation." That's interesting because literally they don't, but in this case, for some reason, they commented that they don't comment. So because of that, speculation is that it's pretty early in the negotiations and a deal hasn't been reached, which is why we didn't get the standard, you know, Apple acquires smaller companies from time to time, and that's pretty much about it, right? That's usually the comment we get from Apple. So this one was an interesting one because it does seem to imply that, hey, maybe they're in talks. Drive AI was actually founded in 2015 by students from Stanford and has launched a self-driving vehicle shuttle service in some cities in Texas, but they have been struggling, which is why Apple may be looking to pick up that engineering talent. As far as what is going on with Apple's self-driving car efforts, we really don't know. There's been a lot of rumors and speculation, a lot of things thrown around. One thing that 9to5Mac did this week was have a great breakdown of all the rumored potential outcomes for Apple's self-driving car efforts. A would be that they simply sell an Apple-branded car. B would be that they run a ride-sharing service using minivans, supposedly, or that's what's been rumored. I think mainly because that's some of the test platforms they use, although mostly they used minivans, I think, for their mapping efforts. C, a Apple shuttle service for self-driving shuttle service for their employees. We have heard that Apple is planning that. And then D, HomeKit for cars. And then I guess there is an E, which would be Apple licensing a system and technology to other car companies. For my money, I'm going to put my bets on Apple going with B, C, and D, sort of. So I think Apple running a ride-sharing service using minivans, that could be a possibility. I still maintain that I think they would do car as a service, more as something that consumers could actually subscribe to, more so than like a ride-sharing service a la Uber or Lyft. They're definitely doing the shuttle for employees. I think that's going to be their test bed, their sort of test platform, beta platform, if you will. And then D, HomeKit for cars, I think that just naturally comes along with the whole thing. An integration of Apple's information, cloud services, entertainment, location stuff with maps and things like that. combined inside the self-driving vehicle, probably with some augmented reality technology on the vehicle's windows so that you can be entertained and get information as you're being driven from place to place. So imagine being able to be in the car, have points of interest coming up on the actual windows, being able to call up your Apple Music, your Apple TV Plus shows and all that sort of thing, and just pick up where you left off. And a lot of the information could be delivered from your device to the car. And that gets even more interesting if Apple is running a ride sharing service or a car as a service, because then any car potentially becomes a vehicle with your data, your information available, and they could do it in a secure way with their security chips so that when you're entering and leaving the vehicle, that information goes along with you securely on your phone. So a lot of great potential there, and I think it makes sense that Apple's going to try to acquire engineering talent from other successful companies that are working in the field. So it doesn't surprise me that they're negotiating with Drive.ai, and I'm sure in the near future we'll probably hear that they did pick up those engineers. Speaking of driving around and vehicle information, Apple's Look Around technology that they showed off at Worldwide Developer Conference is getting some pretty good buzz. This is Apple's new Street View-like feature in Maps for iOS 13. And what people are noticing is that compared to, say, like Google's Street View, Apple has a much smoother transition as you tap on the look around view and move down streets, because what they're doing is rather than using a motion blur kind of transition, they are actually inserting additional high resolution images in between the frames. So you get more of a video-like experience. The street photos are also said to be highly detailed and very good quality, probably more a factor of the due to the fact that Apple has been only doing their data capture, their vehicle capture, for the last few years. I think 5 or 6 years at this point. Google, a lot of their images in their database are much older and just were taken at a time when cameras weren't as good. So I think it's natural that Apple's photos would be a little bit better. For privacy, faces and license plate numbers, things like that are of course blurred out in those images. Another really cool thing about the look around is that you get an augmented reality view with points of interest, shops, and landmarks that are labeled, and you can simply tap on those right in place to get more information. So you can see, a little information dot on a restaurant, tap on that, and of course get the Yelp reviews and other data that Apple has built into Apple Maps. Apple states that they are planning on having all U.S. cities photographed and mapped by the end of 2019, with plans to do other countries in the year after, so rolling out in 2020. Right now, the information in the beta version of iOS does seem to be a little bit limited in terms of the cities. The cities that appear to have the most coverage are Cupertino, I think there's no surprise there, Las Vegas, San Francisco, and Honolulu. And if you haven't seen some of the demos, check it out. You can find them online. They're also available for viewing in the Worldwide Developer Conference video. It's pretty impressive. And, I think Apple is behind in getting this technology out there, but it's looking like it's going to be worth the wait. At Worldwide Developer Conference, we did finally get a look at an Apple TV Plus show. We got an actual real trailer for the Ron Moore series, For All Mankind. That is a space drama television series that takes a look at what would have happened if Russia beat us to the moon and the space race had never ended. And it looks very cool, very interesting. I'm excited to start to watch that when Apple TV Plus comes out. But beyond that, we hadn't seen any other TV show until recently. And at, of all places, Apple showed off a trailer, or I guess it was really Ubisoft, showed off a trailer for an Apple TV Plus show at E3. It was a trailer for a show called Mythic Quest. It's a comedy series from It's Always in Sunny Philadelphia creators Charlie Day and Rob McElhenney. The story is focused around a highly successful game studio, which is, I guess, where the tie-in to E3 and Ubisoft comes into play. And it follows them as they get set to launch the next major expansion for their game. To me, the trailer had a little bit of The Office meets Silicon Valley vibe to it, and you know, I kind of felt mixed about it. I'm certainly probably going to check it out, but I don't know if it's really my bag of tea. We'll have to see, but it was at least nice to get another actual trailer preview of a show coming to Apple TV Plus. Also, Apple is supposedly looking to back some films that may have Oscar-winning potential. The Post is reporting that Apple is looking to back small budget films that may have a chance at winning an Oscar. The piece says that they've been contacting and approaching, quote, elevated directors and other film talent and offering to bankroll them for dollars between $5 and $30 million per project. They say that Apple is looking to back about 6 projects per year. They also say that these deals are separate from the multi-year agreement that they signed back in November to make movies with the studio or the production company A24, which already has some Oscar-winning films under its belt. One production company that Apple was seriously rumored to be considering partnering with was J.J. Abrams' Bad Robot. Unfortunately, it looks like Apple lost out on a bidding war for that one with Warner Media, which stepped up with a bid of reportedly $500 million. Abrams was actually one of the celebrities in the announcement parade that they gave at that Apple TV Plus event when Apple did their services thing. He has at least one show that will run on Apple TV Plus. With this new deal in place, who knows if Bad Robot will be able to produce shows for other services. Time Warner and Warner Media is planning their own streaming service just like everyone else, something that I'm a little bit frustrated by. I was hoping this wasn't the way things were going to go, but it's looking more and more like we're going to have to subscribe to 27 million things. It's also not clear yet if the Time Warner deal with Bad Robot is exclusive. I have to imagine that in this competitive market, it is, at least for most shows that aren't already signed. But we'll have to wait to find out more information about that. Regardless, I'm still very excited about the stuff that is coming to Apple TV Plus, although I'm tentatively cautious or reserved about Apple's chances for success, given the fact that you have things like Disney Plus and some of these other players coming in the market that have bigger budgets, are kind of spending more money, and are maybe a little bit more serious about it. I think, you know, Apple's take is they're going to focus on really good quality storytelling versus volume. Whether they'll have to change that tune in the future, we'll have to wait and see. But I do think they have some great stuff coming to the platform. It's going to be interesting, and we'll find out more in the next few years on whether or not they can be successful. The one place where I'll say that, I think there's hope is if you look at Apple Music, Apple really did pull that off and has been highly successful. So maybe they can repeat the same thing with TV and movie content. Looks like Apple may still be interested in buying Intel's modem business. Again, this information comes from the site The Information. They say that Apple is in talks to buy a piece of Intel's now shuttered modem business. The piece Apple supposedly wants is the German piece because it's the best engineered one. All right. Bad joke, but I had to do it. It's actually considered to be one of the strongest pieces of Intel's modem business. That's because a big chunk of that one came from Intel's acquisition of Infineon in 2011. Right now, it's just talks at this point, but if Apple can get a deal done, it would result in Apple gaining hundreds of talented cellular modem engineers, something that would go a long way to help them create their own cellular modem chips, something they had been rumored considered wanting to do for a while, mainly to break free of Qualcomm's grip. We know that didn't work out, and for the next few years at least, they're going to be using Qualcomm modems. But Apple has hired in the past a number of ex-Intel executives from their modem division, so now if they can grab some more of the engineering talent, that would really beef up their modem division, which has been growing exponentially. At least that's what we've been hearing. The days, though, of Apple's own modem chips are still reportedly years off. They are expected to ship a G5 iPhone in 2020, but they're going to have to use someone else's technology to make that happen, and we know now that will be Qualcomm. Ming-Chi Kuo says he expects the 5G iPhone to arrive in 2020, along with growing and shrinking OLED displays. Yes, I said shrinking displays. I'll talk to you about that in a moment. He believes that the 2020 iPhone will come with a 6.7-inch model, a 5.4-inch model, there's that smaller one, and a 6.1-inch screen size, same as the iPhone XR. It is believed that this will be the first year that the iPhone XR version will move to OLED. So we'll have LED iPhone XR update in 2019, but then the OLED update reportedly in 2020. As a side note, on the 2019 iPhone XR, it is expected to have about a 6% larger battery, which means it's going to have even better battery life. And with the move to OLED in 2020, it should improve even more because OLED uses less battery power. Moving back to what we'll see in 2020, the move of the iPhone from the iPhone XS's 5.7-inch display downward to the 5.4-inch display is supposedly being done to please fans who are looking for smaller devices. Apple has not updated their iPhone SE. As a matter of fact, they discontinued that model, so there is no more 4-inch version. I would imagine the 5.4-inch with the reduced bezels is going to feel like a very nice size for fans of the smaller devices. Combine that with the even bigger 6.7-inch plus device update, and I think what you've done is irritated mid-size phone fans like myself. I kind of feel like currently the 5.7-inch model, the iPhone XS, is just perfect. It's a big enough screen to give me the information that I want, yet it's still fits in my pocket. I'm not sure that I'm ready to go down in size at this point. I've kind of gotten used to it, and that's going to be a hard move. And I certainly don't want to move up to a 6.7-inch gigantophone. So I don't know. You know, it seems like you can't please everyone, and Apple's not going to try. Not that they ever really do. So I'm going to have a dilemma in 2020. Do I go big or go home, or do I just go home to a smaller device? We'll have to wait and see in 2020 what Adam does. The 5G would supposedly have support for both leading standards, the sub 6 gigahertz and the mmWave technology, which is good, but as we mentioned before, it is expected to use the Qualcomm tech. 5G is only expected to come in the 5.4-inch and 6.7-inch devices. The iPhone XR successor in 2020 is expected to remain an LTE device, and Apple's own modem chips are not expected to arrive until at least 2022, but Kuo thinks that Apple will use their own power amplifier and RF antennas in the 2020 designs. I would imagine they might even be able to use some of that tech in this year's models, but we'll have to wait and see on that. The move to full OLED in 2020 has not been good news for Apple's current LCD display supplier, Japan Display. They had already been in financial trouble and were hoping for a $700 million bailout from a consortium, but the bailout got bailed on, reportedly over concerns about the future of orders from Apple for LCD displays. Part of Japan Display's troubles are actually due to Apple's lower than expected iPhone sales after the company agreed to guaranteeing orders, so they're sort of on the hook. Apple has been said to be considering waiving the money owed to them by Japan Display for those orders, and possibly even investing $185 million to keep the company going. Japan Display may begin supplying OLED displays for Apple Watch soon. Apple, I think, actually helped them get a factory for OLED up and running, but they are currently not set up to produce larger displays that would be needed for the iPhone. I would imagine part of the investment, if they do get it from Apple, would go to trying to ramp up production so that they can move to OLED displays for smartphones. And I don't know, I think you just have to wonder, too, if Apple might ever want to just buy a display manufacturing company, and maybe this is an opportunity for them to jump into that market. I always worry about them spreading themselves too thin. I don't think ultimately they want to do that, but they have been taking on more and more of their own destiny. And, you know, if they're investing money to help build out new factories, it could ultimately be a service they move into sometime in the future. But I think for now, they're probably just happy to try and keep Japan display afloat, if for no other reason, so that they can get better deals from their other manufacturers because of the competition. But we'll just have to wait and see what happens with Japan Display and whether or not they can ramp up and start making displays for iPhones. Here's an interesting one, iCloud for Windows. I think many Mac fans don't even know that this is a thing that existed. It actually has been around for a while, but this week Apple introduced an updated version for Windows 10 iCloud, a new app, iCloud for Windows app, available on the Windows Store, or the Microsoft Store, rather. This will let Windows users access iCloud Drive, iCloud Photos, Mail, Contacts, Calendars, Reminders, and Safari Bookmarks all from their PC. It will also let them see and manage their iCloud storage. One of the more interesting parts of the announcement was Microsoft says that the iCloud Drive feature actually uses the same Windows technology behind their own OneDrive files on demand. The iCloud for Windows app can be downloaded from the Microsoft Store now. So if you are a Windows user, or maybe you have to use Windows at work and would like access to your iCloud stuff, you might want to check that one out. And if you do, I'd love to hear your thoughts on it. It's always interesting to hear what Apple experiences are like on other platforms. I think more and more Apple's been getting better at it. We're getting further and further away from the days of, you know, really cruddy iTunes for Windows. I think they did a pretty good job with bringing Apple Music to Android, from what I've heard, and hopefully this update to iCloud for Windows is a good one. And again, if you have a chance to experience it, let us know what you think. Maccast@gmail.com. Another cool feature coming with iOS 13 is Apple is opening up the ability or capabilities of the NFC chip in your iPhone, and that means at least some countries, largely enabled by Apple doing that, are going to start allowing users to store their identification information in their devices. In Japan, we're hearing that users will be able to read the NFC chip in their national identity cards using a government-developed app that will allow a person's information to be stored directly on their device. Also, over in Germany, they've announced plans to make their IDs compatible with the iPhone's NFC. It's going to allow German citizens to put their national ID cards, residence permits, and biometric passports into their iPhones. I think this is really cool, and I hope it's something that the U.S. jumps on as well. We'd also heard in the past that Apple had approved a UK app that's going to let citizens scan the NFC chip in their passports, and it is being developed to reportedly allow EU citizens to more easily verify or apply for citizenship in the UK should Brexit move forward. Apps that are allowed to scan and read NFC chips will need to be approved by Apple on a case-by-case basis, so it's not just wide open, and third-party apps are only allowed to read tags when the app is active and in the foreground. So that is supposedly to help protect security and privacy. You can't have some sort of rogue app, you know, secretly roaming around trying to scan NFC tags when it's running in the background on your device. But I'm very excited to see NFC opening up. I know one of the things that Apple talked about at Worldwide Developer Conference 2 is having like sticker tags that retailers and folks can use and put on products to have those read, and also for like payment terminals and doing things like maybe topping up subscriptions or topping up money on like pay-as-you-go cards and things like that. So you could have those like in your Apple Wallet and just update those by scanning a little NFC tag at a register or something like that. Or maybe even on device. I think they talked about, you know, Bird scooters being able to just like tap that and get right into your account, add money, and then take off. So that's pretty cool. I'm looking forward to see how that technology plays out. And that, again, is coming with iOS 13. One thing that we are losing when Apple launches macOS Catalina is the dashboard. Our widgets that have been with us since, macOS Tiger, those are not going to be with us anymore, at least if the early betas are to believe. There was no macOS, no dashboard found in the beta versions of macOS Catalina, no option to enable it inside Exposé. And then Mac Takara this week noticed that the technology had also been removed from Apple's WebKit. So it's probably pretty safe bet at this point that it's gone and it's not coming back. Sad for something that's been around as long as it has, but you know, it's time to move on. And luckily, macOS Catalina offers a viable alternative in the form of widgets in the notification center. I mean, we have widgets also with us in the Today View on the Mac currently with macOS Mojave, right? You can go into the Today and you've got various widgets that you can add in there. Hopefully, Apple will also take a note from the new iPadOS, which lets you have widgets on your desktop, and bring that over to macOS. So you can kind of have some always-on ones, maybe just sitting out on your desktop. And that was something for a while you could do with dashboard. You had the ability to either run them right on your desktop, or you could have them off on another screen. You'll correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure they removed the capability to run them on the desktop a couple versions ago. I don't remember how far back, and you only had the ability to run them on a separate screen. And now in Catalina, they're going to be gone altogether. When Apple releases watchOS 6, it may be the official Independence Day for the Apple Watch. We actually already knew from the Worldwide Developer Conference announcements that Apple Watch was getting its own app store and the ability to install and manage apps directly on the device. With the prior release of the Apple Watch with the cellular modem, of course, that meant that you could take your Apple Watch out and about without needing to be tethered to a phone. Well, in the current watchOS beta 6, it's looking like you're finally going to be able to at least start OS updates directly from the Apple Watch. So you're not going to have to use the app on your phone, although you will need to accept the terms and conditions over there. But once you've done that, the app will download and install directly on your Apple Watch. They're also adding the ability to delete some of the first-party apps, those apps that Apple installs, so you can take things off like the alarm, the Breathe app, the camera remote, the radio, the remote app, the stopwatch, and the timer. You're also reportedly going to be able to remove the ECG app, the walkie-talkie, and the upcoming cycle tracking app if you want to. Other apps, though, including the heart rate monitor and messages, are going to remain unremovable. And apps that have partner apps on your iPhone, things like Activity, Contacts, and Calendar, those will be removable, but they will require you to actually remove the companion app from your iPhone, which will then remove it from your Apple Watch. That one I'm a little mixed about. It seems to somewhat make sense, although I can imagine scenarios where maybe you want to track Activity or have the Activity app, say, for example, on your iPhone, but you just don't want it on your Apple Watch and you're sort of locked into it still. It makes sense from a syncing perspective. Same thing with Contacts and Calendar. calendar, especially something like contacts, because if you want to make phone calls from your Apple Watch, it would presumably need access to data that's in your contacts. And also to use complications, like with the calendar complication, I'm kind of curious how all that stuff will work. So if, you know, I actually remove that stuff, does it also then remove my ability to have a calendar complication on my watch? You would think not, because it should still be able to display like dates, but it wouldn't obviously be able to sync up and maybe display things like meeting information or stuff that you have on your calendar. So I don't know. I guess we'll have to take a look at Watch OS 6 beta. I'm kind of waiting for some of the public betas to come out. And even then, I'm going to be a little bit hesitant about installing it on my devices. I think overall, we haven't had this conversation in a while, but you know, running beta software, it's beta software. So just know what you're doing before you get into it and install it. Don't put it on any of your critical devices or things that you really rely on day to day, especially say something like your iPhone. I generally don't install betas on my iPhone until they're almost close to release. My iPad, I'm a little bit more loosey-goosey with. I probably will install the public beta of iPad OS on my iPad just because I'm super excited about a lot of the new features and I really want to start checking them out, especially if for no other reason so that we can talk about them more firsthand here on the MacCast. But Apple Watch looking to get a little more independence with Watch OS 6. Some good news if you don't happen to live near an Apple store, because chances are if you don't live near an Apple store, you probably live near a Best Buy, especially if you're here in the U.S. I don't know how widespread Best Buy stores are worldwide, but Apple announced this week that 1,000 Best Buy stores are now going to also be Apple-authorized service centers. Adding Best Buy locations, according to Apple, means that 8 out of 10 Apple customers in the U.S. will now be within 20 minutes of an Apple-authorized service provider. I do wonder a little bit about the overall experience. Is it going to be as good as going to a Genius Bar in an Apple store? Some people might argue that that's not a very high bar, but I personally always still have really good experiences when I go in and talk to a Genius, at least here in San Diego. I don't know how it is in other parts of the country. I know it can be mixed depending upon the Genius that you get. Employees at Best Buy are, I believe, trained by Apple. I think that still is the case. So hopefully you'll still get the same quality service and quality experience, although that's not necessarily something that Best Buy has a huge reputation for. I guess they do okay, but, you know, Apple sets a pretty high bar, so hopefully they can pull it off. I do think it is good news because I do know many of you out there don't necessarily live a convenient distance to an Apple store, and the idea that you would be able to go into a Best Buy and say get a new battery installed in your iPhone, something like that, that's a pretty good deal. And it does look like they are going to be offering a lot of the same services that you could get from an Apple retail store. So I think ultimately that is pretty good. Kind of sticking on the retail side, just because I didn't know where else to throw this story in, we're also hearing that Apple Card testing is expanding to Apple employees. This is after it was made available to Goldman Sachs employees for kind of beta testing. So they're expanding, getting ready for the launch, which should be happening sometime soon here. Employees can get an Apple Card in their digital wallet on their iOS device immediately after approval, but they do need to be running iOS 12.4, which is currently in beta. They say that they will also then ship the physical titanium card to those employees within 2 to 3 weeks. So very, I think almost exactly the same experience consumers will have once Apple officially launches the Apple Card. The public release of the Apple Card is supposed to be happening this summer. Apple has not given a hard date, but hopefully the expansion of this testing is a good sign that they might be getting closer to a public release. I am super excited about the Apple Card coming out, and I can't wait to get my hands on mine. The Apple Card will launch first here in the U.S., but Apple is reportedly in talks with financial regulators in Europe, so hopefully expansion overseas will roll out pretty quickly. I think Apple and Goldman Sachs have a vested interest in trying to get this rolled out worldwide as quickly as possible. So Expect it to happen. I think within a year or two, Apple Card will be available in many, many countries, but only time will tell. And then finally in the news for this week, let's talk a little bit about Catalyst. Actually, more Catalyst. We know that Apple is planning more Catalyst apps like the podcast app in Mac OS Catalina. Catalyst, if you don't remember, is the technology that is going to allow iOS app developers to more easily port their apps to the Mac. And Apple has been eating their own dog food and using Catalyst to create a number of apps. As a matter of fact, they used an earlier version of the technology to develop the Stocks, News, Home, and Voice Memos app for the Mac in macOS Mojave. And those apps are okay if you've ever used them, but I have to admit they've never really felt 100% like Mac apps. They always kind of had an iOS-y kind of feel. Well, Craig Federighi revealed in a CNET interview recently that those apps are going to get a refresh with the updated Catalyst technology coming in Catalina. He says the refresh is going to make the designs more Mac-like, but he did defend the existing apps, saying that 90% of the design of the apps' look and feel came from design decisions to make them not feel not Mac-like. Those were intentional design choices and not something that was limited by the technology. But he does say they heard the feedback from Mac fans, and they are going to make some tweaks to the new versions to make them feel more at home on the Mac. And I think that is a good thing. I'm not really sure why they would have decided to kind of move more in the tablet iOS direction on the Mac, especially since they've always kind of maintained that the two experiences really do need to be different. My assumption is they're trying to get us used to the day when the OSs will merge. And trust me, despite what Apple has said for years and years, eventually this stuff is going to merge together in some form. When and how, I don't know. But I think it's happening, and Catalyst is a sign of that. And I think the name is appropriate now that I'm thinking about it, right? It is a catalyst for change that will eventually be coming. There are also new hints in macOS Catalina betas that Apple could be working on Catalyst versions of Messages and Shortcuts. Steve Trotten-Smith, our favorite developer who likes to dig into these things, was poking around and did find references and information that makes it look like Messages will be coming, because they've added support for the ability to do things like have stickers and iMessage effects, something that's been missing on the Mac version of Messages for a while. I would like to see those features coming over, Memoji, all that sort of stuff. It would also be great, I think, to have Shortcuts, a Shortcuts option for automation on the Mac, especially including Siri Shortcuts. I'm starting to use those more and more on my iOS devices, and it would be nice to have that seamless experience of that moving over to my desktop as well. So I don't know about you, but I am super excited about the updates to iOS 13 and macOS Catalina. I think these are huge, nice updates, and I can't wait to get my hands on them. I think it is going to be a lot of fun. And I'd be curious to know what you think about all this. Are you excited about some of the features? What are you excited about both on iOS and macOS? As always, please shoot me your thoughts, your comments, send me feedback, maccast@gmail.com. With that, that is going to do it for our supersized news for this past couple weeks. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another show sponsor, and that is Linode. Hey, look, if you're looking for hosting, Linode is awesome. One of the things that I think is really great about them is they have amazing technology. They have a great dashboard, but what I really like about them is the amount of choice that you get. They allow you to quickly and easily deploy and manage an SSD server in their Linode cloud, and you can get that up and running in seconds with your choice of Linux distributions and also resources and your choice of locations. They currently have 10 different locations you can host your website at. And best of all, right now, they are giving new MacCast customers a $20 credit. If you've been wanting to set up a server for almost anything, you can do it with Linode. You want to run a VPN? Great. You want to set up a Minecraft, an Arc, or a Terraria server? No problem. You want to run WordPress, Drupal, GitLab? They've got you covered there as well, and they'll let you do it with just about any choice of Linux distribution. They have most distributions available out of the box, but if they don't have the one that you like, you can upload a custom image and create your own. See what I mean about choices? If it runs on Linux, basically it runs on Linode. They have great technology as well. They feature native SSD storage, a 40 gigabit network, and they use industry-leading processors. And like I said, choices, choices, choices. You have 10 worldwide data centers to choose from. They just opened a brand new one in Toronto, Canada. That's great news if you need to comply with in-country data protection requirements, because you can do that while taking advantage of all of Linode's technologies and tools, and they always use the most up-to-date hardware and their next-generation backbone. They'll also be adding an additional data center opening in Mumbai, India in 2019. And another awesome thing about Linode is their pricing. No surprise fees, and you pay for what you use with hourly billing across all of their plans and their add-on services. You can get what you need from a $5 Nanode plan all the way up to high-powered dedicated CPUs. And like I said, their dashboard makes it easy to manage your Linodes, see what you're having to pay, what your charges are, and you can do things like add-on backups, storage volumes, large storage volumes, and load balancing. Plus, they have 24/7 live customer support, a great documentation library that can help you out when you get stuck on a resource. I needed to turn to that when I was setting up some of the security and firewall stuff on my Linode, and I found what I needed quickly and easily and got up and running. So if you'd like to check it out and get a $20 credit, visit linode.com/maccast and set up your first Linode using the promo code MACCAST2019. That's linode.com/maccast and use the promo code MACCAST2019 to get a $20 credit on your first Linode. And a big thank you to Linode for their support of the MACCAST. We want to talk about Apple and your data for a little bit here. You know, Apple is focused on security and privacy of their users' information. I think there's no doubt that that's sort of been their mantra over the past couple years, and they're getting more and more serious about it, putting more and more restrictions on their partners and app developers and all that sort of stuff. And I think ultimately it's a good thing for consumers. But something interesting that I ran across this past week was a series of articles over at Axios, and I'll have a link to these in the show notes at maccast.com, but they did a great job of breaking down a number of different companies, Google, Amazon, Apple, and others, and kind of detailing in a series what these companies know about you, what kinds of information they're gathering, what they are collecting, how they're using it, and those sorts of things. And, you know, they did a pretty good job of covering Apple. Apple does gather data. They try to do it in ways that are different than some of the other companies, but it's good always to have an idea of what they're grabbing, what's protected, what's not protected. And some things still aren't, and Apple is changing that sort of stuff. For example, a lot of people don't know that a lot of the data that is in your iCloud backups, a lot of that stuff is decryptable currently by Apple. They're looking to change that, but if they get a government request or a legal request for that information, and they do from time to time, they can provide that information or some of that information unencrypted. And like I said, that piece at Axios goes into good detail, but you know who goes into even more detail and gives you more transparency and information? Yeah, Apple. And I wanted to talk about that. A lot of people don't know that Apple has a privacy site, apple.com/privacy, and from there you can get to their transparency page. I'm going to link to it in the show notes at maccast.com, and that transparency page has a ton of detailed information about Apple, the data that they collect, and how they protect privacy and where things are, and I think it's a great website to review if you're at all interested in this. And I think we all should be interested in it because you should know what's happening with your data and information. But in that transparency section, what's really cool is they break down very simply and easily the information requests that they get from law enforcement agencies and governments to the ability that they can. Some of that stuff they can't really disclose a lot of detailed information on, but they give numbers in terms of the number of requests, the types of requests, and they explain in pretty good detail the different kinds of information that is requested with various kinds of requests. And I'm just going to synopsize it here for you on the MacCast, but I do encourage you to go, you know, over to the Apple website and check it out in more detail. So basically what happens is, you know, they get these requests. And one of the most interesting things that I noticed on the site, you know, regarding the transparency information and the requests was sort of which governments request information, what kinds of information do they request, and how frequently do they request that? And Apple breaks it down by country and by request type. So I just wanted to cover kind of the various request types. So they have device, financial, account, and emergency requests. A device request generally seeks information regarding customers associated with devices. So they're looking for, you know, who owns this device and device connections to Apple services. So, for example, law enforcement investigations that are on behalf of customers for lost and stolen devices. So if your device gets lost or stolen, you go to a government agency or a law enforcement agency to help you out. They're going to put in, potentially put in a request for Apple to figure out, you know, where is that? Let's track that thing. Let's figure out where it is. And so that's kind of a device request. It could also be for information that might be on that device. So say they're taking pictures and those are going into your iCloud. Maybe you want to get some of those photos so they can help identify maybe who's someone who stole your device, that sort of thing. Obviously, they can be used for other purposes, the device requests, but that's just a general example. Financial requests or financial identifier requests generally seek information regarding suspected fraudulent transactions. So, for example, law enforcement investigations on behalf of customers who have been victims of credit card fraud used to purchase Apple products or services. Account requests generally seek information regarding a customer's Apple ID account, such as account holder name, address, account connections to Apple services. For example, law enforcement investigations where an account may have been unlawfully used. Account requests also seek customers' content data, such as photos, emails, iOS device backups, contacts, and calendars. So those are the requests. The account requests are the ones where they're like trying to get your iCloud information for one reason or another. So I think those are the ones that I would be most concerned about. And then finally, emergency requests. These relate to circumstances involving imminent danger or death or serious physical injury. So, you know, say someone went missing on a hike and family members or people were trying to find them. You know, they fell down a ravine. That might be an emergency request, or maybe there's an abduction, those sorts of things. So generally seeking information regarding a customer's connection to Apple services, for example, instances where law enforcement believe a person is missing or in danger. So to me, again, what was most interesting was how the countries broke down for these various types of requests. For example, China and South Korea seem to have the most device requests, which was not too odd considering that these would be used in fraud investigations for devices. And, you know, we do know that there's device fraud going on in those countries. But more interestingly, Germany and Poland were also very high on that list. And so I wasn't really sure why that might be. The U.S. by far led the pack in financial fraud requests. So I think we have a lot of skimmed credit cards. Anybody maybe know why that might be? Yeah, because we still rely on the stupid Magstripe and readers and seem to have a hard time moving to chip and PIN, or better yet, supporting Apple Pay, something that could better protect us. Yeah, That one's a little bit frustrating. China and the U.S. also had the most account requests. Now, remember, this is the type where they're looking for actual information from, say, your iOS device backups or maybe photos that you've uploaded to iCloud, things like that. These potentially can reveal the most data about consumers, so that is a little bit concerning that the U.S. leads that pack. Across the board, another thing that I found interesting was emergency requests seem to be very low. And this seems to be an area where Apple could most help law enforcement, you know, finding missing people, finding people who might be in danger. I think that's actually a good use and a good excuse to maybe, you know, compromise someone's privacy. If I go missing and people can't find me and my device can help locate me and possibly save my life, go for it. I'm all for people using it in that way, but those requests don't seem to come through as frequently. We do hear about that a lot just with family members using the Find My app to locate missing or family members who might be in danger. So maybe the requests are low because there are other ways to get at that information without having to go through Apple. I don't really know. But again, this is all information that is readily available on Apple's transparency website in their privacy section of their website, apple.com/privacy, if you want to check it out for yourself. And I'd love to get your thoughts on this. If you take a look at it and have any additional thoughts to add to this conversation, shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. So I think currently at this point, most people would agree that from a pure technology standpoint, just really cool tech, Apple has one of the strongest Mac lineups I think that they've had in a long, long time. They have a lot of different options in different platforms, desktop, notebook, and they kind of cover most of the bases from their consumer lineup with the Mac Mini and the MacBooks and the MacBook Air, through to the iMac and the Mac Pro, and even the Mac Mini, if you configure it right, that can be looked at as a pro machine. And of course, with the portables, you've got MacBook Pros, that sort of thing, and the new Mac Pro for the Elite Pro. So they've kind of got the full range of devices for the most part. And I say for the most part because even with all of that, I still think, arguably, there are some spaces in the lineup, especially with the desktops, that Apple could still possibly fill. And I think most notably, it's on the entry level, the sub $1,000 price point, and on the prosumer level. And again, I'm sticking mostly to the desktops here, and even there, there's some fudge room depending upon how you want to look at it. But some of my thinking on this actually came up because of an email from listener Darren, who wrote in to express some frustrations over the lack of a budget option. He happens to be a budget Mac owner, and I think there's a lot of people in this category, a lot of people that don't have $3,000 to plunk down on a new Mac. And while Apple does have some quote-unquote entry-level options that float around that $1,000 price range, if you compare that to what you could get for $1,000 in the PC market in terms of technology, you don't get a lot with Apple. They cut corners a little bit, and arguably in some cases a lot, to get to those price points. And it's not like Apple has ever really been a budget computer company, but we have had points in history when Macs have felt a little bit more affordable than they do now. So I don't disagree with this thought. You know, the Mac Mini, it does have an entry-level price tag of $799, but there was a point back in the day where it was $599 and even $499. So much more expensive entry-level. And when you start to really look at the specs, most would agree it's crippled in certain ways, especially when it comes to storage. Now, it's great that it's fast SSD storage, but you start out at a measly 128 gigabytes. I mean, let's face it, most iPhones or iPads offer more than that now. And when it comes to RAM, you get just 8 gigabytes, which is probably okay for your entry-level consumer, but really, most of us at this point, I think, need about 16 gigs or better. And if you want to jump up to more respectable storage, say 512 gigabytes, which isn't massive by any stretch of the imagination, that's going to set you back another $400. So that's going to push you well over that sort of $1,000 entry-level price point. And you start getting into territory where, do I buy a Mac Mini? Do I get an entry-level iMac where maybe I can get a little bit more? So, you know, it gets a little bit tricky. And you might argue, well, you know, a base model iMac or a MacBook, you know, that's right around $1,000. So that's entry level. But again, looking at the entry level $1,099 iMac, it's old tech. You get a 7th gen Intel processor, not a slouch, but it's not the latest and greatest stuff. And while you do get 1 terabyte of storage, it's an old, slow spinning hard drive. And let's be honest, anybody who's using a Mac with a spinning hard drive these days, spinning hard drive basically means spinning beach ball of death. It's the only way around it. I am constantly getting prompted from friends and family members and people in the community that have older Macs that say, look, I upgraded to Mac OS Mojave on my Mac with a spinning drive, and it's beach ball city. Everything is slow. I'm seeing more and more beach balls than ever before. And really the best solution that I can offer them is upgrade your Mac to an SSD. Go out, get an SSD, put it in there, and it'll be amazing. That jump is amazing. And so I don't understand why Apple can't offer SSD storage at a more reasonable price point. I think they could. I think they choose not to. And again, this is not to harp on Apple or their pricing. They've always been a premium company, but it does get a little bit frustrating. And I can certainly understand that, especially when you have users who have to work on budgets. One way to work around that is to maybe buy a used machine or get refurbished machines. But Macs are becoming more and more popular, and if you tried to go on Apple's store and look at the clearance section or the refurbished section, it's few and far between to find some of those older models and to really get a deal. And, you know, you look at the MacBook, that starts at $1,300. So it's already well above what I would consider to be a budget price. So it is a hole in the market. You know, I'm just pointing this out. I'm not saying it's necessarily a bad thing, but when I hear from people in the community who are a little bit frustrated by it, I want to say, I understand. I can see definitely where they're coming from. And do I wish that Apple would offer up more budget options? Yes. Do I wish that Apple would charge less for their RAM in their SSD storage? Yes. Do I wish that Apple would stop selling machines with older spinning hard drives, especially 5,400 RPM slow drives? Absolutely. I wish all of those things would end. Do I expect them to end? Probably not. And it's not like Apple hasn't had budget offerings before. They did offer a pretty awesome $599, $499 Mac Mini. As a matter of fact, I have a 2006 Mac Mini that's still in use today, and it's freaking awesome, and it works just fine. I use it as a server. It probably works okay, if I'm being honest, because it's stuck on Mac OS 10.6 Snow Leopard. I can't upgrade it past that, so it's sort of frozen in time, right? It's got the perfect operating system for that machine, and it runs perfectly well. Meanwhile, though, my 2014 model, newer Mac Mini, yeah, in order to get that to perform well, and that's a 2014 model, so no slouch, I had to put an upgraded SSD drive in it, and my 2009 iMac definitely showing signs of age. Now, again, the fact that these older machines are serviceable and work really well for a lot longer, you know, that's the counter argument, I think, and a valid counter argument against the need for a budget Mac, right? You're going to spend a little more up front, but hopefully get a machine that lasts you longer. And that's generally true. But again, it starts to fall short when you look at, I've got paltry storage in there. I can't upgrade the RAM. I can't upgrade the storage in it. And at that point, yeah, you can move to externals with Thunderbolt 3 and USB 3 And those are more budget options. But now you're cluttering up your desk with extra cables and things like that. And maybe that's not what an owner wants. So yes, there's workarounds for all these things. There's ways around it. But why should we have to do that? You know, we all want that cool, slick Apple experience where you just pick up the machine and go. You don't have to have a bunch of drives and things that you have to detach from your MacBook and maybe even take with you because you just don't have enough storage. So again, something that I can completely understand. The other underserved user at this point, the guy or gal, you know, who is not finding maybe the Mac offering that they want, is someone who wants an expandable desktop prosumer level Mac. And that is something we kind of had in the past with the Mac Pro. Obviously, the new Mac Pro, which is a screaming, awesome, amazing machine, some of the best computing technology on the planet at this point. Yeah, that's not for us. That's not for the average person. It's not even for the prosumer. It's for corporations. It's for high-level professionals who need super performance out of a Mac. And where we're missing something is in that $3,000 to $5,000 range, right? We've got the iMac Pro, we've got the new Mac Pro, but you're looking at a minimum of $5,000 and probably a lot higher than that when all is said and done. And yes, you can configure something quite nice in this range with a Mac Mini, a MacBook Pro, or an iMac. But there you're kind of stuck with the machine that you get, right? There's not a lot of internal expandability options. You're left to having to use breakout boxes or external expansion again. And again, it sort of detracts from that Mac experience. So more and more, since the release of the announcement of the new Mac Pro, we've kind of been hearing about this concept or idea of Apple maybe doing at some point a mini tower version of the Mac Pro. And I think this could be amazing. So something in that $3,000 to $5,000 range. And I'm sort of thinking just sort of have, you know, cut in half what you have in the new Mac Pro. So instead of 12 memory slots, how about 6 memory slots? And instead of 8 expansion ports, how about 4? And then a similar complement of ports on the outside. You can even have a similar design. Just think of, you know, a half height Mac Pro Tower, and that could be incredibly amazing. Will Apple do it at some point? I don't really know. I do know that there are a lot of folks in the prosumer Mac market that would love that kind of box. And, you know, hey, look, at the end of the day, we're just having this conversation. It's just food for thought. I'm realistic. Apple has never been about being cheap. They have never been about giving consumer choices, the consumer choices when it comes to their machines, right? They kind of say, here's the configurations we think you should have. Here's the price that it's at, and it's not cheap. Take it or leave it. And that's always been the tack that they take. So I don't see them actually changing it. Will they do a Mac Mini tower? You know, that would be awesome. But again, I don't think they're going to do it. It's certainly nice to think about. And certainly we can go and say, hey, there's some stuff missing from the lineup. But overall, look, I am super amazed at what they're offering now. And I think if you can afford it, it has never been a better time to be a Mac owner. There are so many great choices when it comes to the Mac. And I know a few years ago we were having conversations about, has Apple moved on? Is the iPhone and the iPad it for the future of Apple? Have they left the Mac behind? And I think if nothing else, you look at the Mac lineup and what Apple has released for Macs over the past 2 years, you can definitively say, and Apple told us this back then, but you know they hadn't proved it yet, but you can definitively say now that Apple has proved it. They have a great lineup and some really killer awesome machines. But again, you kind of have to have the money to spend. Nothing new, but that's just where it is. So I don't know. What do you think about this stuff? Let me know, maccast@gmail.com. All right, last thing that I want to finish up with in the show for this week is a question, or actually trying to help out a listener with an issue. Andy wrote in, and he is having an odd and what I would say frustrating and annoying issue with the cellular modem in his trusty old iPhone 6S. He says the issue is that he'll be connected to the cellular 4G network. He's over, I think, in the UK on EE and has a strong signal, yet he'll go to use the internet or check his messages, and he will not have received any data on the device, and he can't get out to the internet. As a matter of fact, gets a message saying, hey, you're not connected to the cellular data network, even though, again, the switch is on in the settings. It's, you know, mobile data switch is turned on, and he has a 4G connection, can make phone calls, all that other good stuff. The only way, he says, to fix it at this point is to actually reboot his device, and then it works for a time, but then eventually loses connectivity again. It will connect to Wi-Fi. There's no problems there. So this does seem to be something that is simply limited to the cellular modem. He has tried resetting the network settings in his device, but that does not seem to permanently resolve the issue either. And he does note that it seems to have sort of started with the upgrade to iOS 12. Now, Andy is the first person in our community I've heard having this issue since upgrading to iOS 12. I don't know if there are others out there. I did a little Googling, Andy. I looked around to see if there were other reports of cellular modem problems or cellular data problems with iOS 12. I didn't see anything. One thing I might suggest is maybe that you contact your cellular provider and find out if maybe there is a carrier update that somehow got missed on your device, because a lot of times that has to do with updating the firmware and the baseband and the modem and stuff like that. So maybe there is an issue there or a software update that they could run to help out with that. But barring that, there's just a couple of other things that I could think to try. Maybe some others in the MacCast community might have some tips and tricks as well. But I'm wondering, you mentioned rebooting the device, but you don't mention if you ever just tried toggling the mobile data switch. So one thing you can do is just go to the mobile data switch, turn mobile data off for about 30 seconds, and then turn it back on and see if that reestablishes your connectivity. If that doesn't work, one thing that I found, because occasionally just, you know, my device will lose its cellular data connectivity. One trick that I use quite frequently is simply putting my device into airplane mode. So basically shutting down all of the wireless connectivity all at once, leaving that off for about 30 seconds, and then taking it back out of airplane mode. And one of the things that will do is reestablish connectivity to cell towers, which it can change. Sometimes your device might hold on to one cell tower that is actually further away than another cell tower that's closer to you. And that's just sort of how the cellular network works. So just resetting that can sometimes fix things up. If none of that works, you may need to try backing up and restoring your iPhone completely. I know from your email, one of the things that you were worried about was potential data loss and the fact that if you restore from backup, aren't you just going to have the same problems back, especially if it's related to some sort of software bug? I can address both of those issues. The software bug, it's unlikely, because if it's something with the modem software, that's going to be related to the operating system. And when you do a reinstall from scratch, it should entirely reinstall the OS. That's not going to be restored from the backup. The backup is just going to be the data coming back onto your device. As a matter of fact, most of your apps are also just re-downloaded from the App Store. So all of that stuff should be clean and reinstalled. So you don't have to worry about that. And as far as data loss, I think you specifically mentioned like your activity data, your health data. If you want to retain that, the best way to do it is to do your device backup through iTunes. Make sure that you check on the encrypt data option or encrypt backup option when you do that, and that will help retain your activity and health data. It also maintains your network settings, like your network passwords and stuff like that, so you don't have to re-enter that stuff when you do the restore. So backup and restore through iTunes, and make sure you use the encryption option, and you should be okay there. The only thing you have to be careful about is when you turn on the encryption option, it's going to ask you for a passphrase. Do not forget that that passphrase, because then you will not be able to restore from that backup. You will need it when you go to do the restore process. So put that in 1Password or someplace safe on your Mac, and then have it available when you go to do your restore, and you should be okay. So I would give that a shot. If that doesn't fix things, then my assumption would be that you could be possibly having a hardware issue with the cellular modem itself, and you would need to kind of contact Apple or take it into an Apple retail store, and now I guess maybe a Best Buy store, to have that checked out by an Apple authorized service provider. They can run some diagnostic tests and tell you if you're having a hardware problem and potentially fix it or maybe replace your device. So those are my thoughts on things that you might try. I'm sure some of you in the community might have some ideas for Andy, and especially if you've run into the same problem and found a fix, let us know about it. Send me an email or a comment to maccast@gmail.com. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Thanks for hanging out with me for another one. Before I leave you, I would like to thank my show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, and PDF Pen for iOS, along with PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on their software by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. I'd also like to mention that I am getting ready to send out the next round of Patreon supporter MacCast cards. These are really cool metal cards that go out to supporters who support the MacCast at the classic or higher level over at patreon.com/MacCast. Apologies for it taking a little bit longer than expected. I was hoping to send these out about every 3 to 6 months. It's actually been about a year, so if you've been waiting on yours for a long time, it is coming. I just put in a new order. Originally, I had been hoping, I had a couple of extra blanks from the original run, because there's minimum quantities that I have to order, and I was hoping to find someone locally who could do laser engraving, because these are metal cards that are actually laser engraved with your name and your supporter number. And I wasn't able to find anybody that I was happy with here locally, so I just ended up redoing an order, and I just needed to get enough cards built up so that I could actually put in a minimum order and not have a lot of extra blank cards. So those are currently in production. I am also getting ready to send out for you pro supporters the first bit of MacCast exclusive swag. We're going to have a limited edition MacCast pin that you will be receiving, and that has been designed and ordered up. I will try to post a little posting about that up on Patreon in the next week or so, so you can get a little preview of what that looks like, but expect that to be coming fairly soon. So if you're interested in supporting the MacCast directly through Patreon, you can find out more information. You can check out what that MacCast card looks like by visiting patreon.com/MacCast. And a big thank you to all the folks who support the MacCast on Patreon. It certainly is appreciated. It helps cover a lot of the costs for like things like hosting and just running the show, the day-to-day operation of doing the MacCast. And so you are very valuable to the show and my ability to do this for you on a consistent basis. So thank you for that. MacCast.com/Patreon to check it out. As always, another way you can support the show is by sending in your emails and your audio comments. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send those emails and comments to maccast@gmail.com. Also send your audio comments there. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And another great way to support the show is simply by giving a review on iTunes. If you like the show, even if you don't, give an honest and upfront review on iTunes, and that is a great way to support the show, because Apple uses that to kind of decide what shows they're going to promote and feature and those sorts of things on the MacCast, and that really helps get us new audience and new listeners, and I appreciate you if you can take some time to do that. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. They are at cachefly.com, and all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. You can find them at backbeatmedia.com. And then lastly, if you want to follow me on social media, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or you can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/the MacCast. But that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.